So tonight we're going to do the number 25 Niwapa Sutta. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anahata Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, a deer trapper does not lay down bait for a deer herd intending thus, 'May the deer herd enjoy this bait that I have laid down, and so be long-lived and handsome and endure for a long time.' A deer trapper lays down bait for a deer herd intending thus, 'The deer herd will eat food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that I have laid down. By so doing, they will become intoxicated. When they are intoxicated, they will fall into negligence.'" You know, when you had a big Christmas dinner, you feel like mm-hmm. having a snooze. You're intoxicated with the food. Mm-hmm. "And they will fall into negligence. When they are negligent, I can do with them as I like on account of the bait. Now the deer of the first herd ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper had laid down. By so doing, they became intoxicated. And when they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. That is how the deer of the first herd failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Now the deer of the second herd reckoned thus, 'Deer of that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food, shunning that fearful enjoyment. Let's go out into the forest wilds and live there.' And they did so. But in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that, they lost their strength and energy. When they had lost their strength and energy, they returned to that same bait that the deer trapper had laid down. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. And that is how the deer of the second herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Now the deer of a third herd reckoned thus, the deer of that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. The deer of that second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait. Then having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he did on account of that bait. And they did so. But then the deer trapper and his following considered thus, 'These deer of this third herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. They eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. So suppose we have the bait that is laid down completely surrounded all round over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Then perhaps we might see the third deer herd's dwelling place where they go to hide.' They did so, and they saw the third herd's dwelling place where they went to hide. And that's how the deer of the third herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Now the deer of a fourth herd reckoned thus, 'The deer from that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. The deer of that second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed and by planning and acting as they did, with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. And the deer of that third herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd and also the deer of the second herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did, with the precaution of making their dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place where the deer trapper and his follower cannot come. Then, having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we're not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait. And they did so. But then, the deer trapper and his following considered thus, those deer of this fourth herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. They eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. Suppose we have the bait that is laid down completely surrounded all round over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Then perhaps we might see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they go to hide. They did so, but they did not see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they went to hide. Then the deer hunter and his following considered thus, if we scare the fourth deer herd, being scared, they will alert others, and so the deer herds will all desert this bait that we have laid down. Suppose we treat the fourth deer herd with indifference. They did so, and that was how the deer of the fourth deer herd got free from the deer trapper's power and control. Because I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning, this is the meaning. Bait is a term for the five cords of sensual pleasure. Remember them? Kamachando, remember? Desire for an experience other than that is present. Viapada, anger. You know, don't get what you want, it's frustration. Right? Right? Do you remember them?
The other ones? The other three?
I'm asking you to remember them.
Sloth
and torpor, yeah. Sloth. But first comes restlessness and scruples, anger, and then making rules. You should do that, and I should do that, and this is the right way, and there is a God, and He's going to punish us if, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then sloth and torpor. Wichikicha, it's just like it didn't work anyway. Yeah, it wouldn't work anyway. It's all just a trick. You know, it's just like
cynical view.
Skeptical doubt.
Skeptical doubt.
Familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Ever met any of those? I mean, in your neighbors or, you know.
Dawn has lots of them.
My best friend is the epitome of skeptical doubt. That's true.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, like there they are. Those are the five, in order to convey, this isn't bait is the term for the five cords of sensual pleasure. Deer trapper. No, that can't be true. No, the five cords of sensual pleasure. No, it's not that. I'm sorry. It would be the five senses.
Mm.
The five senses, yeah. The cords, what ties you to sensual pleasure.
Mm.
Right? It's not the five. Okay. Bait is a term for the five cords of sensual pleasure, the eye, the ear, the nose, the five senses, the doors, right? Deer trapper is a term for Mara, the evil one. The deer trapper's following is a term for Mara's following. You know that when you really fall into some kind of seduction of something, that lots of people who are involved in that keep encouraging you to keep going. You notice that? You always find a band that agrees, and that think they aren't right. That's part of the brilliance of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? So you just name that. Hi, I'm Cecily and I'm an alcoholic. It's like not they just wish they could drink, you know, or you know. But I am, yes. And it's just like not good, not bad, this is just what I am. Mm-hmm. Just like this is it. This is the story. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's so beautifully crafted that teaching. Dear herd is a term for recluses and Brahmins. So when somebody has decided that they are really wanting to put all of their focus on the inner, right, and practice meditation and try to see what is the self, you know, what is real here, and then any of the five chords start, come over here. Oh, smell that flower. Nothing wrong with that. It's okay. Then you get intoxicated, and then you go to another one, and, you know? Mm-hmm. Right? Recluses mm-hmm. and Brahmins of the first kind ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait and the material things of the world that Mara had laid down. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, Mara did with them as he liked on account of that bait. And those material things of the world. That is how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind fail to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the first herd. Recluses and Brahmins of the second kind reckoned thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, fail to get free of Mara's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food and those material things. So they're like total abstinence, right? Shunning that fearful enjoyment, let us get out into the forest wilds and live there. And they did so. There they were eaters of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or the discarded scum of boiled rice or sesamum flour or grass or cow dung. They lived on forest roots and fruits. They fed on fallen fruits. But in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that, they lost their strength and energy. When they lost their strength and energy, they lost their deliverance of mind. Basically, their ability to hold their concentration, their awareness. You have to understand the Buddha is speaking of his own experience of trying to cut off all desire and realizing it didn't work. So that doesn't work neither. Oh, should we look at the footnote? Deliverance of mind. Probably means the ability to hold the mind steady on one thing with awareness. What is it? 293. They simply abandoned their resolution to live in the wild, so it could well be that these ascetics had attained and lost the eight meditative attainments that are usually implied by their term Chaito Vimutti. So they had experienced the eight jhanas or the eight... I'm not sure either actually what the Chaito Vimutti means. I am assuming it's the eight jhanas, but I don't know. Do you have a Buddhist dictionary handy? Purification of mind. Purification of mind. Usually they mean by that jhana and insight together, but what I'm not sure exactly. Maybe we can check it later. from my, I can't find the footnote. Oh, here it is. With the loss of their deliverance of mind, they returned to that same bait that Mara had laid down and those material things of the world. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, Mara did with them as he liked on account of the bait and those material things of the world. That's how those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind failed to get free from Mara's power and control. And again, I'm sure you've all heard me say that the way to transcend something is not to negate it. Mm-hmm. But that never works. All you've done is split yourself in half. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the second herd. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the third kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind had failed, and then planning and acting as they did with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place within range of that bait that Mara has laid down, and those material things of the world. And having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily, and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down and the material things of the world. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, Mara shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait and those material things of the world. And they did so. But then they came to hold views such as, this is great. The world is eternal, and the world is not eternal. These are the five questions that Tathagata will not answer. But here they're divided, obviously. I think they might have 10 here, because it sounds like they've got them opposites. The world is eternal, and the world is not eternal. That would be two. The world is finite and the world is infinite. The soul and the body are the same. The soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Tathagata exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. After death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. There they go. The five, or here the ten, 294. Unanswerable questions, the questions that, you know, in various sutras you have people coming and asking the Buddha that, and he just sits there. He doesn't play. Oh yeah, these are the 10 speculative views debated by the ascetic philosophers of the Buddha's age. All were rejected by the Buddha as being unconnected with the fundamentals of the holy life, unconducive to liberation from suffering. So Majjhima Nikaya 63 and Majjhima Nikaya 72 go into them in more detail. So when we get past 20s, into the 30s, 40s, 50s, and the 60s, we'll get there. And do you see why they're not conducive to enlightenment? Okay.
Unending discussion. So your mind, you're just wandering around in circles all the time.
That's true. And what is it that makes them so interesting to people?
Just because people want an answer?
Because it's an answer, therefore there's a right. Therefore I, subject, object.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's self-grasping, wanting to be safe by having the right answer. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And when you actually turn around and do some real work, you know, self is very elusive, to say the least. which self, which right answer for which moment. You know? So it's those are not conducive, the questions are not conducive to awakening. If there's salvation, there's somebody to be saved. If there's no salvation, there's somebody to not be saved. But is there a self? That's the question. What is self? Is there reality without an object? So that's what the jhanas teach you. Practicing the jhanas, you have experience of consciousness without duality, the higher jhanas. Otherwise, it's like in some god realm having wonderful discussions about something that is going to be totally incomprehensible when the sense of self absolutely dissolves. These questions are only reasonable within a limited framework. It's like being in Alberta arguing about whether Ralph Klein should have accepted the new job. You know, what does it matter to a child with AIDS in Africa? You know? Mm-hmm. They're like coming into being, passing away. That's neat, eh? Just looking at that. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free. From Mara's power and control. And the recluses and Brahmins of the third kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind and also the recluses and Brahmins of the second kind had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with the precaution of making their dwelling place within range of the bait that Mara had laid down and the material things of the world, also failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place where Mara and his following cannot go. Then having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily, and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down, and the material things of the world. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, Mara shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait and those material things of the world. And they did so. And that's how those recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind got free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the fourth herd. And where is it that Mara and his followers cannot go? Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon, abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture, pleasure born of seclusion. Right? First jhana has five qualities. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. That is to say, you're not looking for a pleasure outside. You're not trying to have object subject. You're turning around and exploring the qualities of mind itself. And already it's pleasurable. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, so then you take that deeper, you go past thought. And a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind, with applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Third jhana. And again, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware. Still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. So with equanimity, you can watch when pleasure comes up or when displeasure comes up, because they are from the past, right? When you say, for example, you're afraid of, always have been afraid of flying, that's only because you experienced it once. That you name it as that. If you'd never experienced it, you wouldn't be afraid. But you don't know whether you're actually afraid next time, or whether when you go into that state, your mind immediately says, oh, this is flying, therefore I'm afraid. So you don't watch the disagreeable come up and just have equanimity about it. Oh, there's the habitual dislike, and here I am. Does that make sense? So equanimity is a very interesting characteristic, isn't it? When you had that traffic accident, there was equanimity.
Yes.
It was neither like nor dislike. You were aware of those potentials, but your state of mind was very centered. Centered.
It was very, it had a very active quality.
It's very active. Equanimity is not passive. It's alive. Total choices. And sitting in the still point of the turning world. I mean, that's the best description I know of it. Riding a bus.
I hope.
Here's a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. And then comes the first formless jhana. Again, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, this is what they call in the Tibetan tradition, Om Subho Ashuddho Sarvadharma, right? Seeing the emptiness of everything. Or your perceptions as empty. Because your perceptions are based on what was, right? This is a lid. Unless I'm 6 months old, when it's not a lid. What is it then? It's empty. It can be anything. And it can be nothing. But because it's fixed in your mind by your perception. So when you move past with such concentration that you go to that part of the consciousness that is just conscious, without doing reference back and forth to perceptions from the past, you're just totally in the present, and you're not referring everything, right? You're not naming everything. It's very blissful. I highly recommend it. It's like having a bath with your whole heart. A very classy spa. A heart spa. So with the abandoning of pleasure, again with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, A bhikkhu enters a pond and abides in the base of infinite space. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, by completely surmounting so boundless space, boundless consciousness, are the first two formless jhanas. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is an eternal. You see that this is in the Tibetan tradition. They teach you first become aware of the emptiness of perception. And then when you have a really clear sense of that, you practice it, and then you turn around and you say, what is aware of it? You examine consciousness. So this is how they do it in the Theravadin. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, so the next one is no-thingness. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is no thing, nothing, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of no thingness, nothingness. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, and then neither perception nor non-perception is the last of the four formless jhanas. Again, by completely surmounting the base of no thingness, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. Because this is all based on bringing the mind to a more and more subtle awareness. It's not based on the mind referring to the five sense doors, the five courts. Right? Because that's what he talked about in the beginning, the five cords.
But are there still the five sense doors?
Of course there are, but the mind is not focused on them.
Mm-hmm. So the eye can still be operating in all the sense doors?
The mind isn't focused on them when you're asleep.
Right.
Can your eye still be operating? What difference does it make? Is eternity infinite or... Is the world eternal? Is the world not eternal? When you're not there, is your eye working or not working?
So
you know, this is like trying to understand something. The only way to understand it is to practice it and see what happens.
Okay.
If there was a clearer language, it would be written that way. But what you're doing is that you are no longer involved with either agreeing with or disagreeing with the cords of sensuality, the five senses. See something you like running and buying it. Because instead you're looking to the mind door with greater and greater focus and concentration, saying, well, other than perception, what is real? Because we know about our perceptions, don't we? We know on one day we'll perceive something as frightful and the next day we'll perceive it as useful. Don't you know that?
Mm-hmm.
We've all done that at least 5,983 times, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore we know, except that in the moment when there's a perception, we jump for it, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So subject-object, right? I perceive. I heard that. I read that. I know that. And then 10 seconds later, maybe I don't know that. True?
Mm-hmm.
So then if you're not going to believe perception is reality, because, you know, how Amber sees the open door is quite different to how I see the open door, isn't it? Or certainly cat food. We look at it quite differently, her and I. Don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, which perception, like really looking at it, and having a sense of interest in, well, what is reality? What is the ground that is unshakable? And you have to go, is it possible for there to be consciousness without perception? And that's called jhana. Which is developed by practicing things like the blue flower, the elements. Mm. And when you have a taste of that moment of just being absorbed, it's very delicious. And you realize that that felt more like you than when you went shopping. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
So then you start saying, okay, how can I not get caught by the five cords? Including having endless discussions about things that I haven't experienced. You know? Because that's how the mind gets caught, isn't it? Endless discussions about what you haven't experienced. Where does a Tathagata go when they die? I guess you'll have to check it out. Where do they not go? Oh, geez. Is this interesting to you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, very much.
So that's the eight. Oh, yeah, that's the eight. We did neither perception nor non-perception, didn't we? How far did I
yes.
get? Yeah. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara to become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. That's the eight jhanas. That is to say, taking the consciousness to experiencing consciousness at as subtle a level as possible in a human being body. Then you know that state. Then you turn around and know that state, not before. So the last one, again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. And then there is insight looking at how perception and feeling, how they are dependent on causes, right? Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. So he is no longer subject to being caught in believing subject-object based on the perception and feeling. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity, and to have crossed beyond attachment to the world. So, one more footnote, 296. Oh, we didn't read 295 footnote, did we? The eight meditative attainments here must be understood, as some MA explains, as basis for insight. When a bhikkhu has entered such a jhana, Mara cannot see how his mind is proceeding, because it's turned in, not turned out. This immunity from Mara's influence, however, is as yet only temporary. This last bhikkhu, 296, this last bhikkhu, by destroying the taints, has become not only temporarily invisible to Mara, but permanently inaccessible to him. No longer able to be caught. So then Mara practices indifference with him. Isn't that what it said? Let's be indifferent to that herd. Because they might scare all the other herds away if we scare them away. On the cessation of perception and feeling, see introduction, page 41. Shall we do that?
Yes. Yes.
Insight can also be aroused with the jhanas, the immaterial attainments, and the divine abodes as its objects. The disciple enters any of these states and contemplates its constituent factors as subject to the three characteristics, which are anicca, dukkha, anatta. I'm on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I started on the sixth line from the top of the page of 41, in the middle of that sentence, in a minute, yeah. Mm-hmm. Insight can also be aroused with the jhanas, the immaterial attainments, and the divine abodes. So the four form jhanas, four formless jhanas, and loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity as its objects. Anything that takes the mind out of subject-object referencing, out of the senses, and into mind-examining mind. So casino work with the blue flower, they all create that kind of calm. Mm-hmm. It's called calm meditation. Although it's not often, you don't hear it taught very often, in one of the more important ways to attain to some kind of experience of no inherent identity is by combining insight and jhana. Working the two of them together is, I have found, particularly valid for most people. Because if you just try to do insight without a sense of questioning your perceptions, then it's still going to be, I know what insight is and I'm going after that. Whereas if you have an experience of consciousness without object, you know that's a doorway you've never gone into, and man, it tastes good. And you say, well, what is that for your interest? So like any of the states where there is just an experience of great calm or peacefulness, loving kindness, compassion, right? Or the jhana states, any kind of what they call samatha practice works very well. The disciple enters any of these states and contemplates its constituent factors as subject to the three characteristics. So you enter into that state, and then afterwards you notice that you got to that state based on conditions and circumstances, and that state therefore is not a permanent state, although it's a state of consciousness. Your experience of it was not permanent because it was conditioned by having a meditation hall or you know, not in traffic. Mm-hmm. But you know it's possible. Mm-hmm. So when you know it's possible, you're not going to have intellectual conversations about it. And the practice gets more interesting. You know that from the retreat, that the practice got more interesting for most of the people there, didn't it?
Yes.
Even your boring practice got more interesting, didn't it? Mm-hmm. It was a good retreat, wasn't it? It's like, oh yeah. Well, this stuff actually works. I'm not sure what's working, but it's working. Mm-hmm. Very beautiful. Several sequences of meditative states mentioned in the Majjhima culminate in an attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling, which is what this verse was referring to, right? That's what it was, right? Said, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. So Several sequences of meditative states mentioned in the Majjhima culminate in an attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling. So sanya is perception, vedayita, vedana is feeling, ita nirodha, nirodha is cessation. So perception, feeling, cessation. Although this state always follows the last immaterial attainment, it is not, as may be supposed, merely one higher step in the scale of concentration. Strictly speaking, the attainment of cessation pertains neither to serenity nor to insight. It is a state reached by the combined powers of serenity and insight in which all mental processes are temporarily suspended. The attainment is said to be accessible only to non-returners and arahats who have also mastered the jhanas and immaterial states. And then there are two more further discussions of it in 43 and 44, which we'll probably get to in about, what, 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
2 years? sometimes we speed right along.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
With this sense doors experience, let's say a higher, let's say more developed person would not smell and enjoy a flower.
Why would you say that?
Well, Inler is talking about the sense doors and not getting caught in the sense doors.
Not getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you not smell it? And the next second herd of deer what says don't smell flowers.
Right, okay.
And they doesn't work for them either. But what is it that gets you caught when you get intoxicated and negligent? Well, I'll just smell one more flower. That is, say, clinging.
Okay.
Clinging to the agreeable, or for some of us, clinging to the disagreeable, don't we? Some of us love to cling to the disagreeable. I can name one or two people. It's no problem for me to name myself. Any of you ever cling to the disagreeable? Could I see a show of hands on that one? And isn't that interesting? So we get intoxicated, you know? In Buddhism they call that the conceit of inferiority. Oh, how I have suffered. Don't they? Conceit of superiority, the conceit of inferiority, and the conceit of equality. The three types of conceit. And don't we do them all?
Mm-hmm.
So any of them are not actually looking at what is real. We're looking at perceptions and feelings and clinging to them. And painting the same picture over and over again. Airplane, afraid of flying. Now, whatever it is. I mean, that's just a nice one because so many people have evidence of it for today.
Mm-hmm.
Don't they?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes when I'm going to sleep, I can watch myself go to sleep and it's really interesting. There's this little change at some point where the body temperature changes. The whole breath goes into a different rhythm. The whole body changes its rhythm and something clicks over. And every once in a while when I'm going through that state, I wake myself up because it's fear, because I am dissolving. And I don't like to be present when I am dissolving. Don't we have states that we use to go to sleep? Familiar ways we think? Do you ever try changing them? Why don't you? It's very interesting. You know, don't argue, don't do anything, just keep bringing the mind back to something else. Like, how wonderful it would be to watch the process. Can you actually see which breath you actually fall asleep on. You know, that's a very interesting slide, isn't it? When can you tell when you're asleep and you're not asleep? Can you? And can you actually watch the point where this sense of self surrenders into sleep? Can you actually teach yourself to watch the dissolution of consciousness? It's a very simple, we go to sleep quite often within 24-hour period, and we do it at least once, don't we? And there it is, and like just to be interested in that and just watch it. And, you know, some of the time, it's no problem. Some of the time I forget to watch. And some of the time I'm watching, it's quite comfortable, but then as soon as it starts going into that, it just goes into that and I'm wide awake again. And a couple of nights ago I was watching myself going to sleep, and I watched the change happen, and I watched the sense of anxiety that would wake me up, and I just sort of watched myself saying, no, not interested. I just slide right by it. Now, it's the first time I've been able to do that. Because you have to be very calm to do that. If you're focusing on trying to do it, you don't go to sleep. it's so simple, because we all go to sleep. You know? To actually be interested. What is that process of going to sleep? Rather than having all of our stories about it. Because we all have ritual for how we go to sleep, don't we? But at some point or other, you will get so tired that you'll go to sleep. Regardless of whether you meet your rituals or not. Because the body's adamant about that. Within 3 days, you'll go to sleep. Sometime or other. So then we have our arguments about whether you get enough sleep, you know. And I mean, we just go on and on, don't we? But every night, we have the opportunity to watch consciousness dissolve. And every morning, we have the opportunity to watch consciousness. The mornings, I'm not so good at. Sometimes I can get it. Sometimes just before, I can just catch it. Just when I'm on retreat, it's easier. It's quite fascinating. You know, like, it's your mind. You do sleep. But there are all these perceptions and, you know, brick walls around it, right? These habitual ways. Look at what you usually start thinking just before you go to sleep. Make a note of it. When you're wide awake in the middle of the day, take your note out and read it and go, what? That's what I think. What's your refuge that allows you to surrender? Interesting, huh? How long have you been practicing that? Have you changed the other parts of your religion? Maybe you want to change that refuge. It's always nice to try different refuges, isn't it?
So do you even write it down just as soon as you see what you're doing, stop and write it down and then continue to go?
I think what you do is you just like try to ride through it, and then just as you're losing your consciousness, say, I would like to remember that in the morning. And then as you're waking up, say, what was it I wanted to remember? And it'll come very quickly. Then write it down. Maybe you won't get it the first day, but you'll get it. Because if you write it down, you're going to break the whole. It takes a while for us to, you know, surrender the battlements. turn our weapons in at the get our armor on. It's interesting?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. So shall we carry on to the noble search? Have you got the next one?
Mm-hmm.
26. Page 253 in my book. What is it in your book?
253.
Oh, good. We're on the same page. This has got a footnote right at the beginning. Talking about the title, that it's called different things in different editions of the Majjhima Nikaya. So that's for the scholarly amongst you. You can work with it as you wish. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Sawati for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, "Friend Ananda, it's long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could get to hear such a talk, Friend Ananda." Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. "Yes, friend," they replied. Then when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Sawati and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, let us go to the Eastern Park, to the palace of Migara's mother for the day's abiding." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the Eastern Park, the palace of Migara's mother, for the day's abiding. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up out of the water and stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion." The Blessed One consented in silence. That's how in the monastery you consent with silence. If bhikkhus agree to something, they're silent. If they disagree, they tell you why they can't do it or why it isn't acceptable. Some monasteries do that. Then the Blessed One went to Brahman Ramaka's hermitage. Now on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were sitting together in the hermitage discussing the Dharma. The Blessed One stood outside the door waiting for the discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Venerable Sir, our discussion on the Dharma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself." Then the Blessed One arrived. "Good, bhikkhus, it's fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss Dharma. When you gather together, bhikkhus, you should do either of two things." This is a famous quote. It's often translated as speak Dharma, but hold discussion on the Dharma or maintain noble silence. Speak Dharma or practice silence is how you sometimes hear it. This is a very famous quote. 298. M.A. points out that the second jhana and one's basic meditation subject are both called noble silence. Oh, I didn't know that. Aryo Tunhi Bawo Those who cannot attain the second jhana are advised to maintain noble silence by attending to their basic meditation subject. So speak Dharma or meditate. I like it. Two kinds of search. Five. Bhikkhus are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. And what may be said to be subject to birth? Wife and children are subject to birth, men and women, slaves, goats, sheep, fowl, pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold and silver are subject to birth. These objects of attachment are subject to birth. Attachment has a footnote, 299. Upadi. The root meaning is foundation, basis, ground. In the commentaries, various kinds of upadi are enumerated, among them the five aggregates, objects of sensual pleasure, defilements, and karma. N.M. Nyanamoli renders the term consistently throughout as essentials of existence, which often obscures its clear contextual meaning. I have tried to capture the several connotations of the word by rendering it objects of attachment, where its objective meaning is prominent as it is here, and as attachment, where its subjective meaning is prominent. At Majjhima Nikaya 26.19, Nibbana is called the relinquishing of all attachments, with both meanings intended. Okay.
In my book it says these acquisitions, so they obviously either updated or just for information.
Thank you, that's really neat to know. These are objects of attachment, so these are objects of acquisition. I like acquisitions better, don't you? It's more in relation to the meaning of the sutra to me. Are subject to birth, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. And what may be said to be subject to aging, wife and children subject to aging, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to aging. These objects of attachment are subject to aging, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to aging, seeks what is also subject to aging. And what may be said to be subject to sickness, wife and children are subject to sickness, men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sickness. I guess I'm not going to have any wife and children. Husbands, it doesn't apply.
It says men and women.
Oh, it does, yeah. Men and women slaves.
Men and women slaves.
Yeah.
Men.
No, men slaves.
Men and women slaves, okay.
Yeah.
Not men and women, comma, slaves.
Gotcha.
Goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sickness. These objects of attachment are subject to sickness, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sickness, seeks what is also subject to sickness. And here's 300. Gold and silver are excluded from the things subject to sickness, death and sorrow, but they are subject to defilement according to M.A., because they can be alloyed with metals of lesser worth. Mm-hmm. And what may be said to be subject to death, wife and children are subject to death, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to death. These objects of attachment are subject to death, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, utterly committed to them, being himself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. And what may be said to be subject to sorrow, wife and children are subject to sorrow, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pig, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sorrow. These objects of attachment are subject to sorrow, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sorrow, seeks what is also subject to sorrow. And what may be said to be subject to defilement, wife and children are subject to defilement. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold and silver are subject to defilement. These objects of attachment are subject to defilement. One who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to defilement, seeks what is also subject to defilement. This is the ignoble search. And what is a noble search? Here's someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to defilement, having understood the having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. This is the noble search. Because before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, and defilement. I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? So suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Suppose that, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, because in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, is one of the great teachers of that time, "Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this dharma and discipline." Alara Kalama replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This dharma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that dharma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise." Is that interesting to you or not?
Really interesting.
So he could recite it. He knew all the right answers. I consider it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, "By realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this dharma." certainly Alara Kama abides knowing and seeing this Dharma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dharma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness, nothingness, 301. He taught him the seven attainments of serenity meditation, ending in the base of nothingness, the third of the four immaterial attainments. So again, we're into the seven jhanas, seventh jhana. Though these attainments are spiritually exalted, they are still mundane and not in themselves directly conducive to nibbana. Without insight into their nature, the experience is very profound and very real, but it's not permanent. Without insight into their nature, one can be misled by them. I considered not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So suppose I endeavor to realize the Dharma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dharma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, is it in this way that you declare you enter upon and abide in the Dharma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dharma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dharma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dharma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dharma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dharma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dharma that I know, and I know the Dharma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. Thus, Alama Kalama, my teacher, placed me as pupil on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dharma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. The experience of shunya or nothingness is not itself a satisfactory end. It's basically like painting the whole world gray. It's all empty, therefore it doesn't matter what you do, or there's no point in doing anything. Do you understand that? There's still something missing, something lacking. You see the intelligence of this man? This Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. It does not lead to the going out of suffering, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness, but only to continually coming to the base of nothingness, nothingness, only to emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. Not being satisfied with that Dharma, I left it and went away. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. Notice that, still in search for what is wholesome. I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. 303. This is lovely, isn't it? Because it's really giving it sort of his little summary of his years of practice. Both Horner in MLS and Nyanamoli in MS err in their translation of the account of the Bodhisattva's meeting with Uddaka Ramaputta by assuming that Uddaka is identical with Rama. However, his name indicates Uddaka was the son, Putta, of Rama, either biological or spiritual. Rama himself must have already passed away before the Bodhisattva arrived on the scene. It should be noted that all references to Rama are in the past tense and the third person, and that Uddaka in the end places the Bodhisattva in the position of teacher. Though the text does not allow for definite conclusions, this suggests that he himself had not yet reached the fourth immaterial attainment. So this is like for scholars again, basically, to tell you about why this is written differently, who this person really was, or it's very useful for some people. Uddaka Ramaputta replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dharma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there are others who will do likewise. I considered it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dharma." Do you see how faith and knowledge are used differently? Mm-hmm. This is one of the most key things about the Buddhist tradition. That faith in Buddhism is what you apply with knowledge. Not hope you're right and believe that it must be true because you want it to be. You know, faith does not save you. Intelligence with faith lets you find out whether something works. Faith is like the fuel. Intelligence is the steering. You can steer all you want, but without faith. By realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dharma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dharma. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputra and asked him, "Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dharma?" In reply, Uddaka Ramaputra declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So do you remember the four boundless jhanas? Mm. Boundless spaciousness, boundless consciousness, no thingness, and the last one, neither perception nor non-perception. So this is what he's now practicing here. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dharma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dharma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and asked him, "Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dharma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge?" "That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dharma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend, it is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dharma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the Dharma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and acknowledged it in and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. Thus Uddaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. Because in those fine states, there's still this desire to be there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
This desire, which one is grasping for, there's going to be disenchantment. Right? To nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of neither perception. It only leads you back again and again to this attainment. When you really like one kind of chocolate bar, you just keep eating it. Don't you? Not being satisfied with that Dharma, I left it and went away. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by the stages through the Magadhan country until I eventually arrived at Senanigama near Uruvila. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. 304. Majjhima Nikaya 36, which includes the account of the Bodhisattva's meeting with Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, continues from this point with the story of the extreme ascetic practices that brought him to the verge of death and of his subsequent discovery of the middle way that led to enlightenment. So that's it for tonight. Tomorrow we'll, next month, I am coming next month.
Yes.
Just haven't set the dates yet. I'm not going to the Yukon. So next month we'll start looking at enlightenment. I've always wanted to say that.
Cool.
Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Do you find this interesting?
Yes.
Yeah.
I hope so. I find it very interesting.
I find that it kind of describes sort of the path that maybe everybody takes looking. Like I just have a feeling going, like there's just these echoes. Of, you know, oh yeah, I did that. I mean, not that.
Exactly. Maybe not disciplined jhana, but looking for what gave me joy,
Or going looking, you know, talking to this person and watching what they did and imitating it and going, no, that's not quite it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's really nice to see.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okie doke. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Notice this beautiful light in your hearts. It spreads through the room, of course, because it just flooded your body and it's percolating out your skin. It's like boundless consciousness. The walls are throbbing with consciousness. Did you know there's this thing called quorum sensing, latest discovery in physics? You gotta go to pbs.org, Nova Science Now, Bonnie somebody or other, I think it was a week ago Tuesday, pbs.org, I think it is. Then Nova Science Now, not this Tuesday, but a week ago Tuesday, I think it was, on Nova Science program, is called Nova Science Now. This woman named Bonnie something or other, I have to send for the transcripts. She discovered that when enough bacteria, who are single-celled animals, right, amoebas and bacteria, like not even amoebas, when enough of them get together, they all luminesce? Hmm. And how do they know when there's enough of them to luminesce? She discovered that they sense each other and they communicate. So you heard of the speech body, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Buddhism they say where there is matter, there is consciousness. Where there is consciousness, there's matter. So that gold light is actually already shining through your bodies, and it's shining through everything. Shining through the floor, shining through all the bacteria everywhere, all of the cells everywhere that are totally intertwined with matter. The walls, everything is a shining energy. The desire for peace. It spreads right through the city, throughout all time and space. Anybody you want to pray for, just image them, washed by the light. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.